Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Friday afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today, sunny, and it'll be warm. There's a big surprise. We should top out at around 109. And then for this weekend, highs of 109 tomorrow and 111 on Sunday. Currently, relative humidity is at 14%, and it's 105 degrees at KJZZ. In Valley traffic, one accident to tell you about. It's blocking the HOV lane. It's the 202 westbound the Red Mountain Freeway at 32nd Street.
The Arizona State Representative indicted on food stamp fraud charges does not plan to seek re-election. Representative Cecilia Velasquez has filed papers with the Secretary of State's office to remove her name from the ballot. Earlier this week, Velasquez was charged with three felony counts, including unlawful use of food stamps. Arizona House Minority Leader Eric Meyer has previously called for her resignation. He says she should resign and not wait until January.
This is all a distraction from her being able to do her job and deal with the legal issues that she's been allegedly charged with. So I think she needs to probably focus on those things and resign and not be distracted.
Velasquez's office did not respond to KJZZ's request for comment. Her initial hearing is set for July 5th. The Arizona Board of Regents held a special meeting this week in Phoenix. On the docket was an in-depth discussion regarding concerns about leadership transitions at the University of Arizona Medical School campus downtown. KJZZ's Carrie Young reports.
The concerns were initially raised by the Arizona Medical Association. The group recently requested an investigation into why the school's former dean and several academic leaders resigned and took jobs at a new medical school in Texas. During the meeting, Board of Regents President Eileen Klein outlined several actions the group is taking to respond to these concerns, like several future meetings and public hearings. U of A's Senior Vice President for Health Sciences, Joe Skip Garcia, acknowledged the challenges. He pointed out that new leaders at the Phoenix Medical School are already being named. Garcia added the school has identified and is working to fix communication gaps with the Arizona Medical Association. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Today was supposed to be the day the owners of the Arizona Coyotes made a major announcement about where the team's next home would be. Speculation's been rampant that the organization would leave Glendale in its rearview mirror and agree to a partnership with a Native American tribe, specifically the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community. Coyotes CEO Anthony LeBlanc said today the team is on track to find its next venue, but he wasn't prepared to give specifics.
We are down to the point where we have selected a site. We're not at liberty to disclose the site at this point, but we are moving forward and are actually in the process of trading legal documentation between us and the organizations that we're working with.
The Coyotes will soon have a Southwest neighbor in the NHL, as the league has announced an expansion franchise has been granted to Las Vegas. The team will begin playing in the 2017-18 regular season. It's the first major professional home team to land in Vegas. Kara Clark is Associate Vice President of Communications for the Las Vegas Metro Chamber of Commerce, and she joins me. Kara, how big a deal is this for Las Vegas?
Getting the NHL hockey team is a huge thing for our community. We've hosted Major League sports here, whether it's exhibition games and such, but we haven't had a team in the Major Leagues to call our own. And the community is just so excited about what this means for us.
Can a city like that support a team, especially in a situation where you're going to have about 40 home games as opposed to the NFL, which would be about eight or so?
I think that's where Las Vegas has a really interesting advantage over other cities in the country. We have both a large population base that we feel have already signed up and said they want to support hockey. But we also attract more than 42 million visitors a year, and this adds to the type of entertainment that our visitors can enjoy while they're here. And we suspect fans from around the country will want to the excuse to go to Las Vegas to see their home team play the Las Vegas team. And in addition, you know, it gives people the opportunity who don't have Major League hockey in their communities, or perhaps an international visitor that doesn't have hockey, the chance to partake of professional hockey.
Kara, other pro leagues, including the NFL, have expressed concern about the gaming in Las Vegas. So what does the NHL decision tell you about whether the perception of the city, at least in that sense, is changing?
It's an indication that people and professional sports are starting to see Las Vegas as more than just gaming. We really focus on entertainment. Gaming is one aspect of entertainment, but, you know, shows and restaurants and nightclubs and all of those different types of things, music festivals. We've really expanded the entertainment footprint and offerings that this city has for people who are visiting. And Major League Sports is certainly a major entertainment form that people seek out when they come here. And if you think about other sporting events when they're hosted in Las Vegas, for example, UFC, for example, you know, major fights. These are things that have really, you know, those are major sports, and they have attracted a huge audience to our community.
Now, Phoenix has had its own challenges with professional hockey. So what about Las Vegas starting its foray into hosting a pro sports team with the NHL, not as popular as the other leagues, and will include 40 home games?
Well, that's going to be the challenge that the team owners are going to have to address, and that is, okay, you have a lot of enthusiasm for the sport, but how do you now really connect the dots so people feel compelled to go to the games, enjoy the games? You know, part of it's going to be education about hockey, what's icing versus offsides. Some of it's going to be, right now, the buzz around town is what's the team name going to be? And, you know, people are weighing in on all sorts of fun ideas. And my understanding in Phoenix, when the Diamondbacks came to Phoenix, there was a naming contest in the community. Those types of things will start to build ownership of the team and a hometown spirit. You know, the mascot will be important.
Kara Clark is Associate Vice President of Communications for the Las Vegas Metro Chamber of Commerce.
Now, from the ice to the pitch, the U.S. men's national soccer team is in town this weekend for the third-place match of the Copa America Centenario. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Casey Kuhn reports on how local groups are coming together to cheer on their team.
Local U.S. soccer fans got an unexpected treat when the men's national team advanced through group play and into the third-place game against Colombia in Glendale. The Valley chapter of soccer supporters, the American Outlaws, will be celebrating nearby. Starting at 11 a.m., the group will host an indoor tailgate party at Westgate before marching over to the stadium. American Outlaws president Ryan Shira says while settling for third place isn't ideal, he's looking forward to seeing the team on local turf.
The bad news is we didn't make the finals, right? The good news is that was hosted the third place match here in Glendale, so we get a match.
Shira says all 500 of the Copa tickets reserved for the Outlaws sold out in 30 minutes. Arizona United, the local professional soccer team, will hold a Copa viewing party before their match at the Peoria Sports Complex. Here's spokesman Jose Bosch.
So we can have a soccer doubleheader, spend half of it in air conditioning, which everyone loves this time of year, and then they can watch us take off at 7:30 afterwards.
The Copa match kicks off at 5 p.m. at the University of Phoenix Stadium. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
New numbers from the U.S. Census Bureau show the country's Hispanic population grew by more than a million people between July 1st of 2014 and the same date a year later. That's a more than 2% increase. Ben Bolander is chief of the Population Estimates Branch at the U.S. Census Bureau.
California has about 15.2 million Hispanics. In California, the number of Hispanics actually exceeds the number of people who are non-Hispanic white alone. If you're looking at overall growth in the Hispanic population in terms of numbers, Texas is the leader. They added about a quarter of a million Hispanics to their population last year.
Bolander says Arizona's Hispanic population and its population overall also grew during that year. As of July 1st of last year, the state's population was more than 6.8 million. Tara Salamone, a senior demographer in the Arizona Department of Administration, says in addition to the state's Hispanic population increasing, the state is also growing in another demographic.
I think we can say that we're a very diverse population, and what we've been seeing all around the country, I think, is also happening here. We are becoming older.
Salamone says the state's population of residents 55 and older has grown 27% since 2010. Overall, the Census Bureau finds last year 24-year-olds had the biggest population of any single year of age.
It's something we all like to forget about, but every day 130 million gallons of wastewater is sent from our sewer system to a treatment plant near 91st Avenue and Broadway Road. There, it's broken down, treated, and almost entirely reused.
Everything here is really repurposed. We try to be as sustainable as possible.
Dennis Porter is the Assistant Director over Wastewater Operations for the City of Phoenix, and the show's Lauren Gilger went out to the water treatment plant to talk to him about a new project they're working on to make them even more sustainable. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Steve.
So they really reuse everything that comes into their plant?
Pretty much. A lot of it is turned into fertilizer, not for food. And after the water is treated, much of it goes to the Palo Verde nuclear plant, which uses it to cool their reactors. And the rest of it actually goes to the Tres Rios wetlands, which is 450 acres of man-made wetlands just across the street from the treatment plant out there. And Porter took me out to see it, and it's really beautiful.
Yeah, a lot of different plant life. Some of that plant life we actually planted ourselves. Some of it grew naturally because the water's here. The blue heron, you've seen a lot of snowy egrets. There's geese. We have pelicans. There's beaver out here. You know, when you put water out somewhere, the animals and the birds will find it.
So the water from the plant is treated with chlorine, and then it goes here to these wetlands where it's sort of made natural again before it can flow back into the Salt River.
The wetlands themselves do some cleaning. A lot of the cattails you saw, they can take up some metals and some other contaminants. It's a kind of a biological environment that we have to maintain and make it as natural as possible. But it still requires some engineering. It still requires some biology. It's a kind of a mix and a combination of science and magic.
Okay, so what's this new project at the plant?
It has to do not with water, but with biogas, which is a byproduct of the treatment process. And soon the city will also be reusing the biogas that's created there at the treatment plant and selling it as a renewable energy commodity. They signed a deal with a company, Ameresco, to build a new plant on the site there to take the gas, treat it, compress it, and pipe it into a commercial gas pipeline nearby to sell on the open market. So Porter showed me where that gas right now is just being burned off in these large metal towers.
Those three large towers are basically called flares. We burn the we call it dirty gas, burn it off, and right now it's just not reused. So hopefully in the spring of 2018 it'll be in operation, the new plant that'll take that gas, scrub it, clean it, send it to the Kinder Morgan pipeline, and we'll start making some money.
Right. So tell me, how did this kind of partnership come about? You're bringing in a company that does this.
The Sub-Regional Operating Group, which is a combination of Phoenix and the other cities that participate, Scottsdale, Mesa, Tempe, and Glendale, decided, you know, we needed to look into this and see if there is a market for this gas, because it changes over time. We went out for an RFP process, a request for proposals, went through that process. Ameresco was the selected vendor to move forward with. It's taken a while to put that, negotiate that contract. That's now done. City of Phoenix approved it last week.
And tell us, what exactly is biogas?
It's methane that is produced in these anaerobic digesters, just like stuff is produced in your stomach. We produce that gas as part of the biological treatment process for the biosolids that come out of the wastewater.
Is it a significant investment to build this so that we can make some money in the future?
It's a significant investment for the developer, for Ameresco. They're fronting all that as far as the providing the financing for the project. It's about a $25 million investment for them.
And what kind of revenues are we talking about here for the city?
We're hoping that we'll get around $1.2 million a year, and then we'll share that among the cities that are on a pro rata basis.
And this is wastewater, so this is water that comes from toilets, this is water that comes from showers in the sewage system. Do you think people have any idea where this ends up and how it's all reused?
They don't, and they don't really want to know. They're happy that it just goes away from their house. And of course, it's an important job that we do, is to take that, treat it, and make it clean for the environment. It's important for the environment. It's important that you can continue to grow as a city, prosper as a city, and without these facilities, we couldn't do that.
That was the show's Lauren Gilger talking with Dennis Porter, Assistant Director for Water Services with the City of Phoenix's wastewater operations. Lauren, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Downtown Phoenix is becoming known for interesting nightlife with bars and restaurants along with sports and arts venues. And public transit has caught on with the popularity of light rail. And now that progress has been highlighted in the New York Times. Fernanda Santos is the Phoenix bureau chief for the Times and wrote the story. Fernanda, what were the signs for you that downtown Phoenix, or at least the perception of it, was changing?
I have like three specific points in the timeline of my relationship with Phoenix that stand out. And one was basically when I first came to Phoenix in 2002, and I came to a conference in July. I arrived late at night, and I remember getting up early the next morning, ordering room service. You know, it was this beautiful view, this big city, the mountains. So I thought, I'm going to have breakfast on the balcony. And I opened the door, and it was as if I had walked into the gates of hell. It was so hot. And in 2012, I moved. And downtown, you know, I live in North Central Phoenix. Downtown was never a place that I thought about going to. Mm. But then slowly, as I started noticing, wow, you know, there are cool restaurants, cool bars. This is a new place here, a food truck night there. I started joking that Phoenix Public Market would start charging me rent because I would just sit there sometimes and never leave because the music was good, the food's good. There's something here that I should write about because Phoenix is seen as this place where, you know, old people come to retire, or a cheap place, or, you know, Arizona has this reputation of being, you know, intolerant. And I never had that feeling downtown. So I thought, you know, let me see how I can get into this story. And the tech companies to me was sort of like the most logical way to go.
So why are these Silicon Valley companies deciding to come here? Why is it changing now?
In part, the cost. It costs less to do business in Arizona than it does to do business in California. And you couldn't have two more different places, right? I mean, Silicon Valley is hip, young, competitive, crazy, overdrive, 80-hour work weeks type of place.
At what point do you kind of go too far and say, yes, we want to be hip, we want to be interesting, but also it is still Phoenix. It's not trying to be Denver, not trying to be San Francisco, whatever
right.
it may be.
One of the greatest challenges is really the perception that Arizona still has outside of Arizona, of a place of intolerance, right-wing politics, a place that's unwelcoming to immigrants, to same-sex couples. And it's a lot harder to undo a negative perception than it is to destroy the reputation of a city or of a state, for that matter. It will take a shift that is beyond what would happen in downtown Phoenix for people in other parts of the country that have generally looked down upon Arizona and Phoenix to want to come here and even consider coming here. So I think that increasingly we're going to see, if the trends continue, young people becoming the sort of new migrants into Phoenix, not just the retirees.
There are some people I know who will say, well, downtown is a real downtown now. And 15 years ago, that was not the case. But they'll argue at the same time, but in this really competitive environment with other big cities, you mentioned Denver, you mentioned Portland, what does it take to move past that? And do you think the direction is going that way?
Mayor Stanton has been so determined to change the image of the city, and to do that by investing in the downtown. And I also think that, you know, there's such low expectation by people who come from other parts to come here that when they get here, they get really surprised. And it's kind of, you know, it may sound kind of mean to say that, but it's not. It's actually a really great thing because you get here and you go like, oh, it's not as bad as people said. I mean, you may walk out and be 110 degrees in the summer, you know, but I always tell people, hey, you know, there's a grit that's required to get through summer here and don't complain. But then when winter comes along, you know, all your friends on the East Coast are going to be talking about how miserable they are. And you're going to be hiking, you know, at 3 in the afternoon and enjoying life in a way that you can't really do in other parts and not paying an arm and a leg for it.
Fernanda Santos, Phoenix resident and New York Times correspondent, thanks for coming in.
It's great to be here.
The Phoenix City Council this week voted to sell one of downtown's most iconic buildings, the Jefferson Hotel, also known as the Barrister Building, on the southeast corner of Central and Jefferson. Some Phoenicians may also recognize its exterior from a brief appearance in Alfred Hitchcock's movie Psycho. Michelle Dodds is Phoenix's historic preservation officer.
What was very key in the city selling the property was that the Jefferson Hotel, or what was more recently known as the Barrister Building, would be preserved and rehabilitated and that any development that occurred on the vacant lots to the east and the south would be sensitive to that building.
How important is it, do you think, to this city that that particular building remain and sort of look the way that it looks?
Well, you know, that hotel is very significant, very important because of its construction method. It was the it's the first high-rise building that we had that used reinforced concrete frame. In fact, it's the first high-rise building we had at six stories in Phoenix. And it was very important to commerce of the day. It was constructed in 1915, and it was a hotel that catered to salespeople and tourists. And, you know, it offered, you know, a coffee shop and some other amenities on the ground floor. And it was a very prominent corner in Phoenix at the time and still is today. And its architecture is unique. We have several high-rise buildings that are older, but that was the first one. And it's been altered over time. And one of the really nice things that will happen when the building is sold is that it will be rehabilitated. There have been a lot of modifications on the inside of the building. But again, the construction method is what's most important. The marquee is missing that was once there. That will be restored, much like the Lohr's building across the street. So there's just a lot of good things that will happen with the sale of the building. All I can say is I'm thrilled to see that the building's going to be rehabilitated. It's going to be activated. And, you know, it's kind of been a little dead zone on that corner since it's been vacant. And there's so many good things happening in that area that, you know, I'm just thrilled to see, you know, what's to come.
Do you find that there are certain developers for whom this kind of project appeals, this historic preservation kind of thing? I mean, is this something that any developer would be interested in doing, or would some just want to tear what's there down and start fresh?
I think there are a lot of developers that would like to start fresh. But, you know, that building is so important to the history of our city that, you know, the city really wanted a developer that was sensitive to keeping the history of the city and rehabilitating it. And so not every developer, that's not appealing to every developer. It's work. It's hard work, and it takes money to do a nice rehabilitation job on an old building, especially a high-rise building. We just recently had the professional building, or what some people called Hotel Monroe, but it's the Hilton Garden Inn. And it takes a lot of effort to rehabilitate a building like that. And so, no, it's not for every developer. And so we're really thankful that there were several people interested in purchasing the building to particularly feature the Jefferson Hotel and, you know, bring it back to its full glory.
Michelle Dodds is Phoenix's Historic Preservation Officer. Michelle, thanks.
Thanks. I appreciate it, Mark.
A new case of measles was diagnosed Wednesday in Pinal County, bringing the total to 18 in an outbreak that began last month at a detention center in Eloy. For most people, the news ends there. But for health officials, this is just the latest in a daily fight against all kinds of illness. KJZZ's Stina Sieg introduces us to a few of these so-called disease detectives.
We all kind of know how our government responds to infectious disease, right? I mean, haven't we all seen the 1995 movie Outbreak? Remember Dustin Hoffman battling that Ebola-like illness ravaging a tiny all-American town?
You got to isolate the sick, and I mean really isolate them, Billy. We got to get everybody else back into their houses. We got to keep them there.
But the reality of working in public health sounds more like this.
I was calling to see how you were doing. Did you have a fever today?
Jibette Franco is on fever watch, meaning she's calling people who may have been exposed in this recent measles outbreak to see if they're exhibiting symptoms. She's one of a handful of investigators here at the Infectious Diseases and Epidemiology section of Pinal County Public Health in Florence. Many of these disease detectives have a master's degree in public health. Some, like Franco, have decades of experience in the field. But they all work together toward the same end. As program administrator Graham Briggs puts it,
trying to get ahead of an infectious disease that doesn't know what's good or evil or know what borders are or doesn't care about who it infects, it just does its thing.
Right now, that thing is creeping out of the Federal Immigration Detention Center in Eloy, where a measles outbreak began around Memorial Day. As of now, every case has been linked back directly to the center, but Briggs cautions it would be so easy for measles to get out into the general public because it stays in the air for hours, even after an infected person has left the area. He talks about measles as if it's a predator, hunting for anyone who isn't immunized or whose immune system is compromised.
If it finds one of those people, it'll jump into that person, and then it will try to jump into more people from there.
So far, that hasn't happened. That might be plain luck, or because Briggs' team is continuing to make calls, knock on doors, even visit people in the hospital. They're trying to determine where infected people were every moment of every day they were a danger to others, and letting the public know, while keeping in contact with other county health departments and the state's main lab. Investigator Clancy Hill explains they use a similar protocol for more than 80 diseases, from foodborne illnesses to STDs.
Every Salmonella case will get a phone call from us. Every E. coli case will get a phone call from us. Every West Nile case is going to get contacted by us.
Whenever anyone is diagnosed with one of those, healthcare providers are required to contact the health department. Hill likes to think of it as a safety net for the public that most people don't even know exists.
It's almost the better we do our job, the less you should hear about us.
So working in public health is not about public glory or the kind of simple solutions to disease you see in the movies. Remember how in Outbreak, scientists were able to cure a whole town with blood from a monkey? It's a wonderfully simple idea, and also totally unrealistic, says Graham Briggs.
That would make our job so much easier if we could just find that little monkey every outbreak.
With no cure-all monkey in sight, Briggs' team will keep making their calls, doing their visits, looking at data, and waiting until they can officially declare Pinal County in the clear from measles. At this point, that won't be until August, and that's only if no new cases are found. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, reporting from Florence.
And in other news from KJZZ at 2:35, thousands of used cars waiting to be imported into Mexico are creating chaos at ports of entry in Texas and California. KJZZ's Monica Ortiz Uribe reports.
Angry used car dealers protesting in Ciudad Juarez shut down commercial traffic going into Mexico for several hours this week. At a border crossing south of San Diego, a backlog of 4,000 used cars is waiting to be exported, according to the Tijuana Chamber of Commerce. A spokeswoman for the chamber said Mexico's customs agency has lowered the daily quota of used cars entering the country and reduced its hours. The agency didn't respond to requests for more information. The used car industry has denounced new regulations in recent years that include higher taxes and stricter inspections. Mexico's Supreme Court has agreed to review a lawsuit that claims those regulations do not comply with the North American Free Trade Agreement. Monica Ortiz Uribe, KJZZ News, El Paso.
Firefighting and police work are tough, male-dominated careers, but local public safety agencies want girls to know they've got what it takes to do the job. From Tucson, Bryn Baylor reports.
This weekend, the Girl Scouts of Southern Arizona will host Catching Fury, a hands-on camp held at Tucson's Public Safety Academy. 17-year-old Annika Morkin intends to work in law enforcement. She took part in Catching Fury as a middle schooler, in the week-long Camp Fury as a high schooler, and is back to serve as a squad leader this weekend.
We're doing scary things and things that need to be done in group and things that can't get done unless you're encouraging each other.
Girls learn to roll out, connect, and work with a heavy-duty fire hose, repel a building, and execute a high-stakes search warrant with mock firearms. Girl Scouts program coordinator Allie Healy says it's not for the faint of heart.
Catching Fury is an intensely physical day. We treat them like recruits of firefighting and police officers.
5% of Tucson firefighters are women, and that's more than the national average.
And that's Bryn Baylor in Tucson.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. The Supreme Court ruling yesterday on immigration policy continues to reverberate around the country.
It stems from a decision in Washington, D.C. in late November of 2014, when President Obama, frustrated with Congress's inability to pass substantial immigration reform, passed his own order. And it was a move that he defended at that time.
The actions I'm taking are not only lawful, they're the kinds of actions taken by every single Republican president and every single Democratic president for the past half century.
But the Supreme Court on Thursday, in a split 4-4 decision, effectively deferring to a lower Texas court's ruling, blocked Obama's plan. As a result, approximately 5 million unauthorized immigrants who are parents of legal citizens or permanent residents will now be at risk of deportation. House Speaker Paul Ryan says the court voted for legal sanity and to restrain the White House.
This is a win for the Constitution. It's a win for Congress, and it's a win in our fight to restore the separation of powers. Presidents don't write laws. Congress writes laws.
Did President Obama overstep his power? With me now to discuss the broader precedence of this ruling is Eric Citron, partner at Goldstein & Russell. He's also a former clerk to Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Alina Kagan, and a guest contributor to the SCOTUS blog. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So is this about separation of powers, or is this about immigration?
Folks would say it's about both. The immediate effect of the case is limited to President Obama's expanded immigration program for Dreamers and for their families. But the principles that the challengers were invoking have to do with the limits of the president's ability to act without Congress in achieving changes to immigration law.
In the opinion that now, I guess, comes from the circuit court, since it was a 4-4 decision, the principle here is that any money spent on any program requires congressional authorization. And so therefore, because presumably some money was spent to operate whatever it was that the president wanted to accomplish in the executive order, it did not have approval. Is that right?
Well, I think the issue is, in order to get into court and to challenge the administration's action, Texas had to show that it suffered some concrete injury. And Texas's argument was that it was having to pay money out to create driver's licenses for people covered by the program, and that loss of money constituted a concrete injury that gave them a right to be in court. I think there's a kind of odd mismatch between that injury and the set of merits arguments that Texas was making about why the program was unlawful. But that's what kept them there, that loss of money. And so that's what entitled the states to have a lawsuit in the first place.
Which means that according to the separation of powers principles, the president can't do something unilaterally that would cause the states to have to spend money. And if they go to court to reverse it, you know, the whole White House program gets thrown out. It's not a balancing of the cost of driver's license versus the hardship of immigrants, right?
Right, exactly. This loss of money that Texas suffered was just the hook that allowed them to stay in court. And then they can make their arguments about whether or not the president is allowed to act unilaterally in this area. The Fifth Circuit said that the president could not do so. The Supreme Court technically affirms that judgment in deciding the case 4-4, but that has no precedential effect. It's not like the Supreme Court has voted in favor of that outcome or opinion. That opinion will continue to control the case in the Fifth Circuit, but if it ever comes back to the Supreme Court, this issue or even this case, the court would be free to reconsider what the Fifth Circuit has said.
Although it does appear that both the Supreme Court and a number of circuit courts have expressed a strong preference that Congress take up this matter and resolve immigration, and that there not be this policy by fiat coming out of the White House, whatever they think about separation of powers. Would you agree with that?
I will say this. I think the Constitution is set up so that the fundamental first crack at policy lies with Congress, who passes the laws, and the president, who either signs or doesn't sign them into law with the veto power. And the options, the range of policy options that are available to Congress, vastly outnumber what the president is allowed to do. Now, the president is our prosecutor in chief, and since immigration is essentially a choice about where to focus prosecutorial resources and whom to deport and when, the president does have a lot of flexibility in putting that law into effect. But there's a whole vast array of regulatory and legal issues that surround immigration, and it is far better, I think no one would dispute, for Congress to sort them out than for the president to take what actions he can in his discretion.
Finally, you know, stepping way back here, if we look at the beginning of the Bush 43 administration up until now, many would argue that there's been a fairly steady course of growth in executive power on the national security front, predominantly in the Bush administration and perhaps in other places in the Obama administration. Would you say this vote and maybe some others that go along with it might signal that the pendulum is about to swing in the other direction, or is this just a one-off?
I think there's definitely a sense in which the Bush administration expanded the role of the presidency, especially in international affairs and defense spaces. And the Democrats, thinking, well, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, have expanded the power of the presidency in domestic affairs. And the optimist would say, well, you know, having faced down that expanded power, both sides have recognized that it ought to have its limits. The cynic would say, no, the fundamental principle here is this is only okay when my side is in power and not when yours is. And I think there is, it just remains to be seen which direction that ends up going.
Eric Citron is a partner at Goldstein and Russell. He's also a former clerk to Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Elena Kagan and a guest contributor to the irreplaceable SCOTUS blog. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
When you think of landscape art, what comes to mind? Maybe open meadows, calm ponds, and forests? Well, that's not the subject of Tony Winter's exhibit called Desert City, River City. The New York-based Winters depicts the Phoenix area's watershed in a series of paintings.
You know, I've been coming out to Phoenix for 10 years or so with my wife, who grew up there. And as soon as I saw the rivers, reservoirs, canals, and even the resort pools out there, you know, I knew that I really wanted to paint those. And the water landscapes there in Phoenix and around the Salt River Valley are, you know, they're partly man-made and partly natural. And, you know, a lot of landscape painting focuses on just the natural, but what attracted me there was it's a beautiful system. And what I hoped these pictures would do is to help people realize how visually beautiful it is.
Tony, you mentioned that landscape art often focuses only on the natural. Was it difficult for you to focus on some of the beauty, as you say, of some of the man-made features of this system?
Well, it is a challenge because when we, you know, tradition, they say tradition is not about saving the ashes, it's about passing along the flame, you know, and in the world of painting, the real landscape traditions that we can draw on are idealized pictures of nature, and nature as a pastoral scene, you know, the innocent world that, you know, man messes it up, and we need to learn from the way nature created it. But man is part of nature too, and we have to survive, and the way we do it is expressed through our landscapes that we build, and, you know, we call it infrastructure, that's sort of a abstracting, stereotyping word, but really what it is our forefathers and their efforts to survive.
What do you hope that people who come in and see your exhibit take away from it?
Well, I think the first thing is that it's beautiful. This system, it's one that in a way is demonized today, but nonetheless, there is great beauty there, and I believe that people feel love and protectiveness toward things that they find beautiful and understand. So this is the first thing that I hope it does, is it lets people just recognize it as a system. That is, the swimming pool in the resort hotel is really, it's the Salt River, and the Salt River goes through different metamorphoses on the way down there. It's a canal, it's a reservoir, it's a empty riverbed, so it's strange, it's artificial, but it is still beautiful.
Tony Winters is the artist behind the exhibit called Desert City, River City. It's currently on display at Mon Orchid Gallery. Nicole Royce is curator of Shade Projects there.
He's a landscape artist, so he, through the course of the years, learned how to paint the Arizona landscape, which is quite different from the New York landscape. And so this show really goes all across Arizona, giving us beautiful sights of our man-made dams, and then, you know, the Salt River, Agua Fria River, and different parts around the valley.
So just looking at some of these paintings, obviously there's some of lakes and reservoirs, but there's also over here like a swimming pool What are we supposed to learn from that sort of thing?
He's commenting on how Arizona's considered that oasis, how we were able to, even though we're living in a desert, they were able to use those reservoirs and things to make a very hospitable place that people want to come from all over the country and stay here. And so he went, and of course he stayed at some of those resorts, and those are really important to us as Phoenicians, and we're enjoying, you know, those beautiful sites and enjoying the resorts when it gets to be 115, and then we can also go to the natural lakes and things like that.
It seems like we see a lot of photography and other type of art media about water, but I don't know, am I wrong that like a painting, like this is kind of like an old school kind of thing we're looking at, isn't it?
It is. He's inspired by the Hudson River painters, and so it's a very, you know, specific type of painting, and it's more traditional because you don't see a lot of landscape painting anymore, and most don't work with oil because it takes a lot of time and, you know, dedication. And so he is bringing a little bit of that old with the new because he's painting a more contemporary landscape, but it's important because it's, you know what it looks like through a photograph, but he really sat there and studied and painted this while he was here in Arizona.
Do you think that a viewer learns anything about the state or the valley's water situation by looking at paintings like these?
I think so, because we do find beauty in our canals. We run them. We put art around them. We try to keep them beautiful and preserve them. And yes, we're at that point now where we want to preserve the wild, natural rivers and lakes, but it's important that we appreciate how these things were made and how they protect Arizona and its people.
Is there something useful, do you think, to have somebody who's not from here, even though he spent a lot of time here, he's not from here, but sort of an outside view of what it is that in some ways we kind of take for granted?
I think so, because he sees sometimes the beauty that we miss because we see it every day. We walk by the canals, we go to these lakes, but do we always appreciate the beauty and what we have in Arizona?
Nicole Royce is curator of shade projects at the Mon Orchid Gallery in Phoenix. Desert City, River City will be on display there through Sunday. After that, it'll go on to other Valley venues. It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quiz master and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner, Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this riddle. Throw away the outside and cool the inside, then eat the outside and throw away the inside. What is it? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. And now for a tiny desert concert. That's when we bring local bands into the KJZZ studios to play a couple songs for us and talk a bit about the music. Today we hear from Nirantha Balagopal of the band Language Barrier. Its music is somewhat poppy with tinges of sadness and thoughtful lyrics. I started by asking Nirantha about the name of the band, which often evokes confusion.
I just thought it was a funny phrase at first when I first thought of it, but it's actually grown to match the music as we've grown as a band. A lot of my songs are conversations that I want to have with someone that I can't, and I haven't figured out a way how to have that conversation, and my music is how I'm able to talk to them. So it's about that communication hurdle.
When you write a song that is basically something you'd like to say to somebody, like, how literal do you try to make that? Like, do you want the person to know that you're trying to say this to them?
Yeah, and a lot of times they do know if it's about them.
Is that awkward?
It can be, but I take it in stride.
So you describe your music as sort of sad girl pop.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean to you?
Back in the 1990s, there was this genre called emo, bands like Sunny Day Real Estate and American Football, and the musicians in that band were often called sad boys, and there was not a lot of female representation in that scene. So I always called myself a sad girl as like a defiant juxtaposition to like the boys club that was the emo genre. And so it's carried over to my music, mostly because I only write songs when I'm sad.
Why is that?
Because when I'm happy, I don't really have too much to say. I'm still trying to figure out how to write a happy song without sounding obnoxious or like shoving my happiness in someone's face.
So Nirantha, can you guys play us a song?
Sure. This song is called Allow Me.
One, two, three, four, five, six. Allow me to be
You've said that you like to compare your band to a desert sunset. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I did say that. So we don't have any official recordings. We just have a couple demos that I did in my living room last year. We play live pretty frequently, like once every month or two. And every time we play, it's a different experience from the previous show. Like, I call ourselves piano pop, but I don't even play piano at some of our shows. And there's four core members, but sometimes there's more or less of us, just depending on life circumstances. So we can kind of evolve and fit to those circumstances. In the comparison to the desert sunset, I think all of us really identify with the desert. We're all from here. And every sunset that you get in Arizona is different from the day before or the next day. So in that sense, every time you see language barrier, it'll never be the same sound twice, at least this far.
How do you think this place, and in some sense this vast desert in which we all live, has influenced your music?
I was actually just saying the other day that I think the desert is both oppressive and resilient. And I think that it causes a lot of creativity in our community. So I'm hoping that the oppressive heat that we're feeling right now, like, inspires us to stay in a little bit more and be creative. But the desert is inspiring because it is really resilient. You wouldn't expect as much growth as there is here. And I mean that in a couple different ways. We have Phoenix, which is like one of the biggest cities in the nation, come out of this desert. But we also have a lot of green in our own way. We have cactuses and Palo Verde trees. And I think it's just really amazing that there's a lot of growth in the desert. And in that way, like, when I get sad, I can still get something good out of it, which is a song or two.
You mentioned that you don't really have any formal recordings other than what's been done in your living room or at performances. Do you expect that to change?
I really hope so. The reason is circumstantial. I'm in grad school down in Tucson at the University of Arizona. The rest of the band lives here, so it's hard to get together. And when we do get together, it's usually because we're playing live.
And you're an engineering student, right?
Yes.
It's just such an interesting combination that you're a musician who obviously plays multiple instruments. You're an engineering student. I mean, is there overlap between those two fields?
I think that most people would say no, but I really believe that there is. I think for a lot of people who don't know science or engineering, they might not know how creative of a field it is. When you're an engineer, you're presented with a problem and you don't have a way to get to the solution. And there's no right answer ever. There's just multiple creative ways to get from the problem to the solution.
So, Nirantha, can you play us one more song?
Sure. This song is called Fingers Fists.
I've been talking with Nirantha Balagopal of the band Language Barrier. You can see video of this and other Tiny Desert concerts by visiting kjzz.org/tinydesertconcert. And if you're in a band or know of one that you'd like to hear play a Tiny Desert concert, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.